Bruce Moore, president of the Institute for Active Citizenship, Ottawa, in Ontario, Canada. Bruce Moore serves on the board of directors of the North-South Institute and the Forum on Democratic Global Governance. From 1998 to 2008, Mr. Moore was the founding director of the International Land Coalition, headquartered in Rome, an alliance of UN, civil society, and multilateral organizations, promoting policies to enable the rural poor to gain their resource rights. He currently represents the Asian NGO Coalition and the Social Development Foundation in North America, and serves on the NGO Food Security Policy Group. His NGO career from 1973 to 1998 included 10 years as the Director of Partners in Rural Development. He has chaired the NGO Advisory Committee to the United Nations International Fund for Agricultural Development, served on the International Executive of the Society for International Development from 1998 to 2008, being an advisor to the European Commission, FAO, African Union, Asian Development Bank, and World Bank. He has chaired a number of high-level policy dialogues during the Commission on Sustainable Development and was a member of the Implementation Advisory Committee to the Commission on the Legal Empowerment of the Poor. Finally, and not least, he is a member of Transparency International. That's quite an exciting part of his life. He captured my attention yesterday with his question on land tenure. I don't know if you remember that. I said, this guy, you have to be careful with him. He's a strong believer in capacity building, in providing poor of the world with help to allow them to build up or plan or create their own development, so they become more likely citizens of development rather than simply clients of development. Bruce, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you very much. I have to pull this down, and I always hope that height and stature are different things. I have two children, and when they were young, they're now adult children, they often said to me, Dad, you have a stunning grasp of the obvious. I'll hope that in addition to what may be the obvious in what I have to say, there'll be some things that stand out. Because certainly I have found some things have stood out beyond the normal in comments that I've heard in the last 2 days. The context in which I will make my comments is something that has also come out in the meeting, which is that the development gap within countries, whether they are in the north or in the south, has been widening. In many ways, I would suggest this is because more and more people have more that they want to conserve in each of these countries, be they elites in developing countries or those in the north. But at the same time, more and more people are becoming reactionary in all parts of the world. Some would even suggest pre-revolutionary. Because after all, who wants to conserve food insecurity, poverty, and declining living standards? The issue that I want to share with you flows from something that I was not planning to say, but the reference to the International Coalition, I hope, will indicate that the opportunity I had to be the founding director of this organization was an opportunity to see whether the multilateral community, primarily the United Nations system and the Bretton Woods or the international financial agencies, could find common ground with social movements to look at the issue of food security, recognizing that it may be possible to work on some areas without having to agree to all areas, given the wide gap that these organizations have often had with one another. This is the context in which I'm trying to draw on the experience of my introduction. But let us look at the starting point for this meeting, the food price spikes of 2007 and 2008. And yes, as we have heard, it has spurred efforts to improve actions. But it has also fueled large-scale land acquisitions in developing countries by foreign investors. their dominant rationale is not to address food security in developing countries. Their motivation has been to circumvent the global food markets and the prices that this would involve for their citizens by being able to grow food elsewhere in the absence of adequate resources of their own in order to control food prices in their countries. Capital-rich countries have been, therefore, acquiring large amounts of land. We've heard some interesting comments as to how one might judge this, land grabbing or acquisitions, and I will come to that. These acquisitions, however, are not only a trend that we experienced related to food in 2007 and 2008, which has accelerated as we looked at the trends the last few days with increasing rising food prices in years since then, but it is also based upon demand for fuel, fiber, for ecosystem services, as was just mentioned, and very often, as we've also heard, because of policies related to biofuels. This is meaning that we are seeing a world in which we are growing corn for cars instead of corn for people, which does raise a food security issue and perhaps a more deep ethical and moral issue. For example, in 2009, Saudi Arabia experienced its first major shipment of food from land it had acquired in Ethiopia, while in that same year, the World Food Program was feeding 5 million people. In that same year, we see that China, which had acquired 7 million hectares of palm oil land, or land that was food production land, which they converted to the production of palm oil in the Democratic Republic of Congo, were experiencing their first imports back to China. Obviously, this is meaning there is a growing level of competition between local populations who have historically depended upon this land for perhaps subsistence agriculture with a hope of turning it into income-generating agriculture are in conflict with these investors. Whether they have legally acquired this land or not, it doesn't change the fact that these people are losing their main source of livelihood. In this context, there are several ways in which civil society is trying to move forward. One is to form cross-sector partnerships with the various citizen organizations which they represent and with the private sector. In the changing nature of the aid and development community, we have to take into consideration that aid and development represents far less in terms of financial transactions than direct foreign investment. Direct foreign investment completely surpasses, by any measurement, the levels of aid and development flows. And it would be completely naive to therefore look at addressing these issues in the global sphere through looking at the aid and development agenda, even if it was possible, and it's not showing signs of being possible, to maintain the levels of concessional finance from the international financial community or the aid levels, including from countries such as our own. So civil society organizations are looking to work with the private sector in the hope that they can influence the forward-looking private sector to see that there are ways that they can legitimately be involved, while on the other hand, forming partnerships that can have meaningful impact at the community level. Such actions that the civil society is bringing forward in their discussions with private sector holders are the principles of free, prior, and informed consent. How does a company that's going to work in a foreign country know when they have been given the proper permission to operate there? Looking, for example, at the mining companies as opposed to agriculture companies, because the mining, oil, gas, and mineral companies from our country working abroad are often getting concessions to land where the surface rights, where the food producing lands of local communities. The mining association, with all respect for what they're doing, are and should be given credit that they're in a process of trying to identify criteria that they would propose that Canadian mining companies should follow when they look at prospecting rights in a country in terms of free, prior, and informed consent. Are they dealing with the legitimate as compared to the legal authorities in granting that land? Has the government and elites seized lands that were informally held and therefore have legally recorded them, but the legitimate intergenerational users of those lands have been displaced, and encouraging that if companies who want to have security for their operations wish to gain that, they have to try to seek also the free, prior, and informed consent of the local people who've used those lands historically and allow those people to have reason to believe that they will benefit from the investment as opposed to being evicted from their agriculture lands. And the other is to encourage the private sector to take into consideration the principles that underpin almost every international agreement of the United Nations, which is the principle of do no harm. Private sector firms that are operating and seeking to expand their operations abroad that are forward-looking are also looking at having these relationships with both international NGOs and community-based organizations in the countries where they hope to operate, because increasingly they recognize that, especially due to social media, that their reputations can be harmed very quickly in the North American media. So if we look at the concerns that I've mentioned of a foreign investor, you're interested in security, the legal right to operate, and you're concerned about your reputation. Reputational risk is the single largest new factor that is affecting how Canadian companies and other international companies are looking at operating abroad, because they can no longer hide from criticism that may be on the social media tomorrow. Look at the Mara Mine situation that the social media brought forward only recently. It was reported in a report on business in the Globe and Mail of the work in Tanzania. As you said, time goes quickly, right? Let me therefore turn to one of the key factors that has to be looked at in working with other parties, and this could be the same in Canada. I've talked about the concern of elite capture, but if we're looking at the underlying factor here is the one mentioned yesterday, and that is that investing in technology markets and the other factor markets that improve production without first looking at the fundamental legal rights of people to their resources, their land, the investments are all too frequently, and the evidence is very clear, captured by elites. People living on marginal lands have improved production over many generations to have elites seize that land. So we have to have that concern, and that therefore leads to the question that the institutions and the people who control rights to land or control the conditions of agriculture workers are in the hands of the powerful non-poor. It leads to the reform question. Is it possible for these institutions that have been created by elites to serve their own interests can be transformed to serve the interests of people who have historically been disenfranchised, are frequently not adequately organized to exert power, and therefore we're dealing with an issue of power and powerlessness more than anything else, not an issue of principle. So let me turn in the short time remaining to several areas where I think if we want to act, we need to give more attention. The first that's come out is to act upon the evidence that with the proper inputs, and often the same inputs that governments have provided to the commercial agriculture sector in terms of the infrastructure and the financial credits needed, smallholder farmers and family farmers can produce more food per unit of land than commercial farming. This inverse relationship that I raised in my question yesterday, the evidence is very clear, but only if we make these investments. And if we do, the yield gaps that we've talked about can be closed. And in fact, the evidence would suggest that this will relate to, in total, larger aggregate food supplies because of this higher productivity level per hectare of smallholders. But the, in doing so, we have to fight what I would say, particularly as I see the government of my country, is that there is a tendency here, but also elsewhere, to return to what evidence caused us of great concern before, which is a market-led approach on the basis that if the wider economy grows, that there will be trickle-down benefits. And the evidence would seem to suggest that we don't see where this has happened. Another area is to look at the ways in which we can strengthen the capacity of governments. The discussion that occurs on corporate social responsibility has many positive features, but it has one major flaw. It is not the role of corporations to provide social and services and public goods. In the international arena, when corporations are building the schools, providing the clinics, and providing infrastructure, they're doing that because it's far less expensive than having to pay appropriate taxes and service costs to be there in the first place. The fundamental issue is that governments, often due to corruption, are quite happy to have these kind of arrangements, but it's meaning that the public goods that need to be provided, of course, are not possible because there's not an adequate rate of recovery of costs and services or taxes from these investors. Another would be to look and make sure that as we see shifts from some toward more and more bilateral free trade agreements, one of the concerns that is growing is that we are not seeing what were hitherto for international standards embedded in free trade agreements. Free trade agreements are all too often seen as business is business, and development and social issues and environmental costs are things we'll deal with in some other place. Whereas international agreements try to bring these things together, as we've seen that they should be brought together. Therefore, the takeaway messages I would like to leave with you is that, and they're stating the obvious because you've heard it from others, is that we have to be concerned with the tenure rights of family farmers, and that we have to help also to look at the conditions of agriculture workers. Because if you're someone at this meeting thinking about things in terms of developing countries, even if smallholder farmers, and in particular landless people, had access to land, the complex requirements to be a successful smallholder farmer are just that, they're complex and demanding. Many people, some 500 million people in the world, work as agriculture or farm workers. And therefore, this may be a place that they can better build their livelihoods, but it's the conditions of work. So one should take a look at the campaign of the International Labour Organization on fair employment conditions in agriculture. The other that I'd want to reinforce, because I've heard it, we heard yesterday about the moral economy versus the commercial economy. Increasingly, people are looking at a rights-based approach as compared to only a market-based approach. And we heard some very interesting evidence from the presentation on Mexico upon looking at social and human rights. I think that we need to look at this more deeply. We need, and I will close, that we need to also look at not so much corporate social responsibility, although we should not neglect it. We need to look at how to support citizen organizations in countries where foreign investors are coming to ensure that the impact benefit agreements that are being signed truly provide them with a fair position in terms of being able to negotiate access to knowledge, access to collective bargaining, and access to legal services. In closing, and in the theme of this conference, food prices and political instability are by no means new, and we all know that. It has been an intergenerational issue, particularly in the developing South. But also, I hope we all go away with the message that there are things we can do and we need to do, because if we continue to do what we have been doing, if you, the younger people in this room, follow only the pathway that's been led by my generation, if we continue to do what we do, the chances are we're going to get more what we've got. And what we've got is a lack of effectiveness in properly addressing the human rights and food security rights of people who for generations have been denied access to their rights. And we've all too often, as was said, think about people as being clients. Let us start to think about people as being citizens, as we do in our countries. Citizens have rights. Public officials have responsibilities, and systems of accountability must be in place. Because the principles that we've talked about in this meeting, I would suggest, given the range of organizations that you've heard I've been involved with, the heads of state that I have met with, we don't lack the principles being embedded in constitutions. What we lack is a failure to comply with agreements that have been set. So we need to look at rights, responsibilities, and accountability. Thank you very much.
Thank you.